Hello again, everyone. Welcome back to The Point. I'm Ed Mullins, and with me today is Tom Kniff, who's running for Manhattan District Attorney. Tom, welcome. We certainly see a change in city. I looked at some of the things that you are advocating for, some of the things you oppose, and I want to give you a chance to speak to the members of law enforcement. So welcome, and thanks for joining us.
Yeah, no, I really appreciate you having me. It's so essential that we have these opportunities to get the word out. My opponent is so well funded by the extreme progressive left, and running as a GOP candidate in Manhattan is not easy from an institutional standpoint, getting the backing that you need to do this. I don't think the voters are the problem. In fact, I know they're not because I've talked to more than I can count, but it's getting the buy-in from the higher ups. So coming on the show, getting this opportunity to speak to law enforcement, the base, if you will, it's golden.
Tom, for the viewers, you know, those who don't know you just see you pop on the screen. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself? I know you're in the military, you served in Iraq, you're a graduate of Hofstra Law School. Give them a little background as to who you are.
Yeah, I'm happy to do that. So I was born in Brooklyn, raised mostly on Long Island, and then, you know, became a Manhattanite after law school. I'm a former prosecutor. I worked for several years for Jeanine Pirro and briefly under Janet DeFiore in the Westchester County District Attorney's Office. During my time there, I also because I'm a commissioned officer in the Army National Guard, I deployed to Iraq in 2005. I served into Crete. I was the chief legal assistance officer for the 42nd Infantry Division. We were the first National Guard division since Korea to have command and control of a theater in war. I was responsible as the chief legal assistance officer for basically an area the size of West Virginia, tens of thousands of troops. Did some civil affairs work over there. Was involved in, ironically, now that I'm doing this, the Get Out the Vote campaign for the first Iraqi election. Everybody remember those being the blue right? Yeah, I was going door to door that day. You know, upon returning from Iraq, myself and a fellow veteran who's my current law partner, Stephen Razor, you know, we ultimately decided that, you know, it was time for a break in government service, or at least in full-time government service. I've remained in the Guard ever since. We started a criminal defense practice, and I've been doing that for the last 15 years. More recently, I came on active duty at the Javits Center immediately during the lockdown last March in 2020. And I've really been, except for a short hiatus, I've been on active duty with the Army National Guard since then. It actually just came off orders yesterday, believe it or not. So, you know, that's my background. I've been on both sides of the criminal justice system. I'm a public safety and law and order candidate. That's the only reason I'm doing this. Having said that, I understand the needs of a fair criminal justice system, the due process rights of accused. I've represented all sorts of folks, including a number of police officers in the crossroads of the criminal justice system, also at 1PP. You know, so I, you know, I'm here because I believe that we need to continue what we, or resume what we've been doing since the founding of the union, which is an adversarial system where prosecutors prosecute, fairly, and defense attorneys defend zealously. That's what I believe is the best system. Can always improve it, but we don't want to turn it upside down like my opponent proposes.
Right. And. Well, we'll go into what he proposes. It's unthinkable. I almost think he should be running for district attorney in San Francisco when I look at some of the stuff that he's involved in. But
what's he's going to bring here? I mean, that's
the playbook. There's no doubt that's what's going to happen. I want to raise a question that you just brought up, the purple finger. When we, and I say we as the United States, helped to create democracy in Iraq, you know, purple finger was used to create voting. A big issue here is voter registration, voter identification. What are your thoughts about that?
Look, I don't see why. I mean, this is not, you know, in the wheelhouse of my campaign. It's not a campaign issue per se.
Sure.
You know, if you ask me, you know, I don't see why in 2021, requiring someone to prove their identity when they vote. When we require people to prove their identity to walk into an office building and a variety of other places, it's an issue. It needs to be done fairly. The IDs need to be free. We don't want, if you're saying, people bring up Jim Crow, poll tax, I don't want, if someone can't fill out the application because they're not fluent in English, we need to have interpreters at every site where they get the, it needs to be open to everyone. I mean, we'll send someone to your house and fill out the form with you. But as long as it's open and available to everyone and there's no systemic barriers to someone getting it, then I think, it's the only way to ensure a fair system.
And you bring up a good point.
Jurors who come to the courthouse and we don't let them get on a jury by claiming they are who they are, say they are, they have that identification. And there's just countless examples of analogies.
Got Pete Panuccio just joined us. Pete, my old partner, retired sergeant. Going to add a lot to this conversation, I'm sure. Hi, Pete.
You can see if
you... I nearly just added a lot to the trash heap with my brand new laptop that doesn't work.
Have you recovered from Whiskey Tavern?
Yes, I am recovered.
At my age, that's a two-day recovery, that place.
I have to tell you, it was great meeting you the other night. And a lot of nice people there, people that are really interested in what's going on in their city.
You know, it's funny. We've done so many, kind of quote unquote bougie fundraisers. And, finally we said, look, we're going to do one at, a local Whiskey Tavern, is local courthouse bar. For those that don't know it, you'll find prosecutors, defense attorneys, cops, court officers in there. We did a really down to earth one. But I think people had as much fun, if not more, in that setting than at some of our more fancy events.
You know what, though? It's good to see that you're getting people from different walks of the community that showed up. They're getting involved. They're interested. They want to get active. It's like every day is another bad headline of, what is wrong with this picture? What don't these people understand? And
it's funny that, and ironically, well, not ironically, I mean, fortuitously, maybe is the right word. I don't know. Whiskey Taverns in Chinatown and, the Chinese community, I spent that day, we went to three different events with three fairly prominent Chinese associations and, they're so supportive, they all gave endorsements. Frankly, there was a desperation on their face. I mean, when I mentioned to them, what I'll do differently. And we brought up Alvin Bragg's, one of his signature proposals is that he's not going to prosecute petty larcenies, retail thefts under $250. They were horrified because so many of them are store owners. So many of them are retail people and they're already being victimized. I was in CVS. I did a couple little video vignettes there last week. A week before that, I was in Duane Reade. You go through those places, everything's locked up, right? Well, CVS and Duane Reade, look, they can afford to put the fancy locks on the goods and stuff like that. But if you're a small retailer trying to get by paying Chinatown rents, you're dead.
I'm in Midtown Manhattan, and several of the Duane Reades closed down.
Sure.
Others are going to restricted hours. The only 24-hour store now is the CVS. CVS is paying a uniform cop on paid detail to be there 24/7.
Yeah.
If you go to the other one, the Duane Reade by my house, it's like watching a show with people darting in, darting out, armloads of stuff. You as a customer have to stand there and wait because half the stuff you need is now under lock and key.
Yeah.
It's not an environment for business to operate in.
It's no way to run a first world economy.
No.
It's a third world economy.
So we would be safe to say that you would not support larcenies of up to $900 like they do in California, where you can just walk in, help yourself, and walk out the door.
Yeah, I think, absolutely not. I think the threshold in Philly with nut job Larry Krasner, who's turned that city upside down, is 500. I mean, look at, Alvin Bragg, bless his heart. He's only given us a $250 threshold. You read articles and you talk to folks there. I mean, they just they call it open looting. You just come in and the people fill up the bags. It's the security guards are quitting because they're like, this is demoralized. We can't do anything. And it's a point I always make, if anybody wants to paint me as this, you know, the far right, you know, Republican who wants to put everybody in jail. Well, first of all, you know, I've been practicing criminal defense for 15 years. I know more about protecting the rights of the accused. And I save more people from prison, including black and brown people, than Alvin Bragg ever will. We can talk about later about all the people, all the mass incarceration he was actually an instrument of in the Southern District. But, you know, you look at Duane Reade, you look at CBS. I actually talk with the employees and they're like, look, it's horrible. Because I went in the other day, I had to get like three items. And I'm like, yeah, I don't have a good attention span for retail shopping. So I got what I really needed. It was like toothpaste or whatever. I'm not going to go to the other aisle and try to track down another associate to unlock the hair gel or whatever I needed to get. Rogaine, I think it was. You know, I engaged the employees and they look, you know, it's horrible. They said people get frustrated, they leave, sales are down, people are quitting. And, you know, what's really so illustrative about this kind of thing and the progressive policies in general. So if you look at a Duane Reade in CBS or CVS in Manhattan, in the Bronx, anywhere in New York City or most places in New York City, most of the people working there don't look like me. All right. The majority of them are black and brown communities. And they're great people and they're trying to make it like an American society, like anyone else. And they are the ones most terrorized by the progressive left's policies, because when those stores shut down, first of all, it's hard to attract retail business to underserved communities. So a lot of them are anchor retail in those communities, supporting the real estate market and the retail market and their employers. So, you know, when you literally chase them out of town, which is what these policies do, the people most impacted are unfortunately those who need them the most, and they tend to be, you know, people in underserved communities.
We've seen that with the shootings and the homicides. You know, we talk often about Black Lives Matter, and you know, the people who are being shot and killed in the street don't look like any one of us.
Of course, you know, and it almost sounds petty to talk about retail theft when you have shootings that went up 97% in the first year of bail reform, and of course. And that just really underscores the point is that, right. You know, the victims of the violent crimes are, you know, it's one thing to take someone's job away. I'm not minimizing that. It's one thing to close a store in a minority community. I'm not minimizing that.
You're raising the point, though, from the smallest of crimes to the highest of crimes. It's not people who look like us.
And
the system is completely flawed at this point, where we're not protecting anyone. And, you know, you mentioned $250, you know, in Philadelphia, but that's per person. That could be thousands of dollars a day walking out and going to a business.
And you know, we keep talking about CVS and Duane Reade. You know, talk about a corner guy running a bodega.
Right.
You know, he or she may only ring $250 a day.
Sure.
Or that may be the most they help to make a profit. And what three or four guys? You know how these stores are. They have the same miscreants that target the same stores, and they're coming in all day. You know, the other example I bring up is look at the frontline workers, the transit workers, right? There's not many guys that look like us that are driving subway trains in New York City,
no,
driving buses. And I got to tell you, I get emotional when I talk about this, because I think of I have one daughter in college and three little girls, and there's no better feeling than, you know, I think Ronald Reagan once said that getting home and getting to the door of your apartment or your house, and knowing that people on the other side of the door are waiting for you. And, you know, my daughters, when I'm coming home, whether I was coming home in military uniform or this uniform, you know, so excited about daddy's back from work, daddy's coming, you know, and, you know, you could kind of feel their pride, you know. And I remember my father left some things to be desired, but one thing, he always came back from work in a suit because he had a corporate job. And I knew that meant something. You know, imagine the shame that a hardworking, you know, black or brown or Asian, you know, who's driving a bus in the city. I mean, can you imagine a more grating job than having to deal with commuters in Manhattan and Manhattan traffic? And you come home and you tell your kid that, you know, I got spit on today, or I got slashed, or why is daddy in the hospital because he got attacked by some maniac who's released on bail reform. I mean, I can't get the words out without getting emotional about it.
We underscore the value of their jobs, and they keep the city moving. I mean, they get us to work. And
I think I'm, you know, what my bad day at work looks like. You know, granted, you know, when I'm on military duty, there's been some bad days, but I look at my bad day at the office. You know, there's some aggravation, there's an unruly client, what have you. That's nothing compared to waking up at 5 a.m. in February. when it's snowing, when it's raining, and having to confront the often an ungrateful or unappreciative public. You know, this is New York. We're not the most gracious of folks. And then, you know, okay. I mean, that's one thing. Then you're not protected. The legal system is not protecting you from violence perpetrated against you. That's unconscionable. And that's when I cease to be able to understand people like my opponent and the ideology that supports him.
I feel like your opponent are part of the problem why the legal system is the way it is. They are fostering a system that encourages crime. And they are basically opening the floodgates to criminals who know that there's no penalties. So they go and they do it anyway.
Yeah, of course. I mean, my saying is when you abandon deterrence, people become undeterred.
Right. Exactly. And that's where we're taking. I got to ask you a question. You run on a Republican line. What support are you getting from the Republican ticket?
Well, and the line I keep using is, it's not a line. It's the reality. I wish I could tell you something different. I will firmly believe, we can talk about this more, that voters are not the problem in this race. And anyone who thinks that hope springs eternal or delusions of grandeur. First of all, I don't have delusions of grandeur because I never wanted to be district attorney. This opportunity came to me and I saw what was going on. I said, look, I'm not gonna shy away from the battle because I feel so strongly about what we're fighting for. My problem is, you know, and I'll invite anybody to come out and canvas with me. We'll go to anywhere you want to go. I was in front of Zabar's a week ago, and you know, one of the more liberal places in the city, and I was embraced. I was out there for 3 hours. It got dark. I had to leave. The voters in this race, in my opinion, are not the problem. The problem is getting the institutional support. The people that, look, everybody hates money in politics, as do I. I've never been comfortable asking anyone for money. It's the worst part of this job. But I'd like to see you live without it in this field. Because the reality is, without a buy-in from the heavy, you know, supporters, the Republican billionaires or Democratic billionaires who want their city saved, you know, I can't get my message to the voters. They don't know I'm here. They will vote for Alvin. Look, Alvin Bragg got 33% of the Democratic vote in a 25% turnout primary. 25% of Democratic registered Democratic voters came out. Now, primaries like that, especially low turnout primaries, tend to favor the ideological extremes, right? So even factoring that in, 2/3 of those who showed up didn't vote for Alvin Bragg. This race will have Republicans. I know they're outnumbered heavily by Democrats. We'll have independents. But most importantly, we'll have moderate Democrats that, you know, the people that probably voted for Tali Weinstein, the few that voted for Liz Crotty, who I agree with her positions, but she just wasn't a strong candidate. You know, they're ripe to come over, as are others that just didn't vote at all. That are now more concerned about crime because it keeps getting worse. But what I need to stop hearing, and I'm not going to name names, but from some household names that you would all know, is that could write me a five-figure check the way I could buy you a cup of coffee, the Republican can't win here and you don't have any name recognition and so forth. Well, first of all, did anybody know who Alvin Bragg's name was 6 months ago? Most people probably still don't know who his name is.
Now, the Republican Party in New York State has really dwindled away and changed itself in many ways.
It's terrible. I mean, we had how many, five, six administrations of Republican mayors in New York City in very recent history. And the difference is the reason why the far progressive, and I keep saying progressive, I'm not talking about Democrats in general.
Sure.
Reason their playbook is successful is because if I, as a reasonably minded, well, no, let me switch that scenario. Assuming I was a progressive leftist and I was going to say, hey, I'm going to step up and I got the resume to back up my candidacy, which I do, by the way, and I'm going to flip an upstate county red. Right. And this has happened. I mean, we've seen this upstate.
Sure, it's happened. Absolutely. Yeah. Right.
I'd have $500,000 in progressive PAC money behind me before I could say, you know, before I could blink my eyes. All right. And, you know, here we have the inverse and it's just not true. And, you know, I talk about the playbook because people also need to realize that this is, you know, what is happening here is orchestrated. You brought up San Francisco before, and we talked about Philadelphia, Chicago, 40% of the cities in the country are now under the leadership of progressive DAs. Uh-huh. Because people want progressive DAs? Absolutely not. This is the playbook that is used by Soros and his types. They descend on these district attorney's offices, like Philadelphia. I knew the prior DA, Seth Williams, in Philadelphia. Someone called in a show yesterday. I'll say, oh, he's defending Seth Williams. Not defending Seth Williams. I served in the guard with him. He had his problems, and he got removed from office, and rightfully so. When he was in office, though, he actually believed in prosecuting crime. He was an African-American Democrat, by the way. They descend on those opportunities, and there's a reason why they choose the district attorney's offices, because most people don't understand what a district attorney does. It's an obscure office to those that aren't in law enforcement, that aren't attorneys, that otherwise aren't very politically astute or engaged. And people don't pay attention. Just like now, we hear about the mayor's race, the mayor's race, the mayor's race. You hear very little about my race.
True.
So it provides an opportunity when one candidate like Alvin Bragg is pumped up with millions of dollars and the other candidate is not supported anywhere near at that level. But the reason they descend on the DA's races is, one, the opportunity it provides to win, but secondly, the opportunity it provides to disrupt the system. Because George Soros and far-left radical progressives believe the American system is unjust. They believe that if somebody commits crime, it's a result of oppression, racism, systemic what happened.
They're small percentage of the system, right?
There's no way to undermine a society than by undermining law and order. And by the way, they're succeeding admirably.
There's no doubt. I mean, just recently there was a show on Stalin, the apocalypse Stalin, and I'm listening to what's taking place, and he's reading, well, the impact of what he was doing had come from Karl Marx's playbook. And I'm listening, and I'm going, oh, that's what's happening here in New York City. That's what's happening in other cities around the country.
If we had a hostile country, South American country was led by a dictator that was, completely, bent on the destruction of the United States. What better playbook would be for the CIA to go in there and undermine, sure, their criminal justice system to create disruptions that we could, back a friendly ruler? In fact, we've done versions of that
throughout. Absolutely, sure.
So it's a rough thing, but you bring up that point, and look, I can't run a dainty campaign. I got to be in your face. I got to, So I'll say to anyone, look, if you agree with my view, look, if you don't agree with my views, then obviously you're not going to support me. But if you're someone who otherwise agrees with what I have to say, and you have the power to do something, you're potentially a wealthy donor, a head of a police union, a transit union, what have you, and you're going to sit back while people are dying and say, well, look, I'm not going to stick my neck out there, or I'm not going to write a check, or I'm not going to endorse someone because, I don't think he can win and I don't want to ruffle feathers, then you know what? You're a lost cause. Right? You're living your life like
you become a zombie. Part of the problem.
Yeah, you're living your life like a zombie, and I don't care how much charitable work you did, how many names on hospitals you have. You're dead. I'm sorry if that sounds
brash. Yeah, I agree with you. You're either part of the solution or part of the problem. And
that's right.
I think we have a lot of people sitting on a sideline just thinking someone else is going to carry the water. And it's the job of everyone to carry the water right now. I mean, we're in I describe it as a revolution without weapons is what's taking place here in this country. When you think to New York City, it took us almost 25 years to bring New York City to where it is today. And de Blasio single-handedly destroyed it. And he did that with the help of the very same people you describe as being part of the problem, that they just want to sit on a sideline.
Listen, I bring up, I just finished Bratton's first book, I think it was, Turn
Around. I wouldn't spend a dime on his books. Yeah. Probably.
Well, look, I don't know Bill Bratton, but what I can tell you is that, whatever him and Giuliani did, with broken windows, what have you, whatever you think about Bratton or Giuliani these days, Look at the raw data. I mean, 1990, sure, we peaked at 2,400 murders. The late Bob Morgenthau, I was at his retirement party at Javits in 2009, hearing these statistics. But by as recently as 2017, 2018, we're under 300 murders a year. You know, you extrapolate that, you know, saving a couple of thousand lives over 25 a year, over 25 years, 30 years. You're talking about as many people as we lost during the entire Vietnam conflict, right?
Great.
Now, for argument's sake, right? We all know the statistic is much higher, but let's say only half of those folks would have been black or brown, right? You're talking about not saving hundreds, thousands, but tens of thousands of black, brown, and brown lives saved as a result of common sense law enforcement policies, broken windows, you know, believing the buy-in that we're talking about in law enforcement. Because prior to that, the conventional wisdom on the street was, look, crime was a sociological problem, the result of poverty, whatever, and you're never going to be able to cure it. Maybe you can kind of contain it. And there was no fix. You know, policing, no matter what you did, couldn't help.
Well, crime in New York City, and Pete and I came on right around the same time, we were basically handcuffed as the police from making arrests for narcotics, making arrests for gambling, making arrests for prostitution, because we were coming off the 70s with police corruption. And NYPD and the mayor's office all believed that if we continued down that path of making those arrests, the corruption would continue. And what it did was it forced an atmosphere to drug dealers and, you know, the gamblers and all the things that we see, the little crimes in the street. It forced the atmosphere that was okay to do. We're seeing that again now. And what baffles me is that, you know, police commissioners, chiefs, people who know better, turn a blind eye. And they allow it to happen knowing it's wrong. Just like you highlighted earlier, to sit back while people are dying, to accept that. And that's what we're watching right now. So the system needs a change. And the things that you're saying, they're not extremist things that are being said. The law and order things, which is the foundation for this country. That's what we all...
Foundation of a civilized society.
Exactly.
Back to the start of recorded history.
Right, exactly. I got to ask you a question. Since you're on the other side as a defense attorney, one of the big issues that we hear all the time is reform, reform, reform. And the people who keep screaming for reform are basically in favor of giving the keys to the jail cells to the criminals so that they can just go home. I mean, that's the extreme of where we are with reform, bail reform, all the things taking place. If you could change something regarding reform that would, you know, answer a question toward reform, and I'm not talking about the bail reform thing, but that needs to be changed. With all your years of experience, what would your suggestion be to bring to the people to say, we need to fix this in the criminal justice system?
Well, I mean, you alluded to the answer. I mean, my first thing is the bail reform. I mean, the reality is that you can, you know, it's funny because, you know, you hear some of the people trying to take a moderate stance, like Eric Adams and so forth. And, you know, you hear this out of the White House, more cops, more cops, more cops. Well, for more police, but more police to do what?
Right.
You're never going to be able to have a police officer on every subway car and every subway platform and every corner, nor do we want to. I mean, the same people that were railing about, we don't want this to be a police state and so forth, now want to make it a police state.
And even if we did, they wouldn't allow us to enforce the law. So
exactly. So I made this point yesterday on Twitter. Look, you know, 10 cops, you know, one cop who's allowed to do their job is better than 10 cops that isn't allowed to do their job.
Exactly. Tom, I want to bring up a point. Somebody asked me the other night at the get together, are the subways safe? You know, I saw more cops for a little while. I said, listen, you could put 100,000 cops in the subway. If they can't do their jobs, same anywhere, then it's a waste of time. Well, I said, we've been down this road. It's called potted plant policing. Okay.
Well, and the greatest
stand on the corner.
You know, I'm with you. I'm with you, Pete. And the greatest example of that, I mean, look, man, bail reform is number one. You never get in the city back until the bail law is put back together and cops can take dangerous people off the street. It is physically impossible to get control of a city when someone commits a burglary or commits a robbery, and they're in burglary and robbery, at least certain subsections are still excluded under non-bail eligible offenses. You know, also people, you know, point I make, you know, there's so much misunderstanding out there. We see these videos of some thug walking up to an Asian woman or a Jewish person wearing a yarmulke, punching them in the face and saying, well, it's a hate crime. Look, it may very well be a hate crime or motivated by hate, but it's not a hate crime unless you're going to be able to prove and make out a prima facie case that they acted on racial or ethnic animus. So unless they utter a slur or something like that, often it's only a misdemeanor assault three because there's no weapon involved, right? And how do you prove the intent to cause a serious physical injury with just a punch? So a lot of people don't realize how violent a nonviolent offense can be, and all misdemeanor assaults and many other offenses are excluded from bail reform. We can't get the city back if those people just get put back out on the street, which is what we've been seeing for the last year and a half. But to get to the subway real quick is, look, what did we disband last year? The anti-crime units. What did the anti-crime units do? I knew
because I insanity.
Defended a lot of these cases as a defense attorney. Perverts in the subway, you know, maniacs in the subway, and guns, right? I mean, that was anti-crime. That was their trifecta, I would say. We disbanded them last summer. Surprise! Subway attacks up through the roof. Hate crimes up through the roof. You know, with less people riding the subway. I mean, the other thing that drives me bananas is, well, crime's up because of COVID. We had, you know, half the people in Manhattan fled to greener pastures, the ones who could afford to flee. Those big office towers that we see everywhere were unoccupied.
And, vacant.
You know, you guys being on the job know this better than anyone. You know, what is the biggest catalyst for crime? You know, bars and nightclubs, right? They were shut down. Yeah, we have a, you know, it's like, crime. I mean, it's absurd. But those are, to me, those, you know, you got to get plainclothes units back on the street, which Alvin Bragg poses as a civil rights issue. And we got to get bail. We got to get the bail reform, which, by the way, Alvin Bragg not only supports bail reform, he wants to double down on it. He wants to eliminate cash bail completely and have every one of his assistants, it's in his, you know, in glorious day one memo, operated with a presumption of release in every case.
Tom, I think we kind of have a good understanding of where your positions are. Alvin Bragg has got a lot of crazy things in his background, and we're only kind of touching on it. He's received $1 million from progressive PAC funds. He plans to decriminalize resisting arrest, which certainly encourages perps to fight police officers. Decriminalize criminal trespass, so people hanging out in your building, obstructing governmental administration, all, you know, issues that have a big impact to minor crimes that with police, through assault police and fight and resist arrest. I mean, I think he has to answer the question, and we want to get him on. If someone resists arrest to a police officer, is he telling us we should just let them go? I mean, his position is total lunacy. So, you know, he's been for mass incarceration. Tell me more about what he's done and what his position does.
Well, first, you'll never get him on. You'll never get him to answer the question.
Well, I'll put an empty chair here. We'll point to
the strategy. And, of course, the mainstream media is utterly complicit. You know, if I see one more interview of him strolling down the sidewalk with a reporter like Lester Holt looking at him with doe eyes, it'll drive me crazy. I mean, NBC Nightly News did a series, Justice for All. And did they invite Tom Kniff, who's been fighting for justice in the civilian world, the military his whole career, 15-year defense attorney, on to talk about it? No, they invited Alvin Bragg, career prosecutor, who put a lot of people away for some draconian sentences in the Southern District. And that's the story that the mainstream media, at least as of yet, still won't bite on. I've actually done their work for them. I pulled every case on Pacer, and I said, look, I'll email you. I'll save you having to go on Pacer and pay the 6 cents per page. And by the way, for folks who don't know, the federal courts have been on an electronic filing system for the last 20 years or so. So you could literally see everything that Tom Kniff has ever done, every motion I've ever filed, and so forth in federal court and any other attorney, including my adversary, Alvin Bragg. So, you know, look, I, like a lot of people, thought Tali Weinstein was going to pull this out. And then she, as far as the Democratic primary, then I think she shot herself in the foot with spending $10 million and the same week it came out, of her own money on the race, and the same week it came out, she hadn't paid taxes. So the night of the primary, when it looked like Bragg was going to pull it out, I went on Pacer. The very first case that you see Alvin Bragg handling in the Southern District of New York, opposing a motion to vacate a life sentence against a nonviolent drug offender who was found mentally unfit. True story. And I would love if the media would fact check me on this. He has numerous cases where he's seeking decade-long drug sentences against nonviolent drug trafficking cases. Alvin Bragg, you know, tells this story of he apparently has had guns drawn down on him 6 times. You know, 3 as a teenager, 3 times as a by police, and another 3 times by, you know, I guess perps in the neighborhood. Meanwhile, he went to a very illustrious private high school. and then went to Harvard. I've represented Bloods, Crips, Latin Kings that haven't had guns drawn on them six times. But I'm not going to discredit the story. I wasn't there. But he tells that narrative by saying, look, you know, the things he saw as a teenager led him, you know, led him to realize how cruel the criminal justice system is. His brother-in-law went to jail for a year and what sounded like maybe an aided robbery, but you know, it was something involving a gun, but he wasn't the one who actually possessed the gun. So he saw how cruel that, you know, it was to send people to jail for gun cases. On his website, he says he's not going to cooperate with ICE because ICE separates people from their families. Well, when you look at Alvin Bragg's history in the Southern District, he has numerous cases where he sought and obtained protracted multi-year federal prison sentences for people for simple gun possession. I'm not talking about a robbery or anything like that. They bought the gun in Virginia. They brought it to New York. Alvin Bragg sent him to jail for a few years. Numerous cases where he sent people to jail for multi-year sentences for reentering the United States illegally, not committing a crime upon reentry, reentering illegally. One guy, you know, had a prior conviction for DWI in Suffolk and was deported. He came back in. Alvin Bragg got him a federal prison sentence. The drug cases, it goes on and on. So, you know, this narrative of, you know, I had this life in Harlem that opened my eyes as a teenager, and then you're in your late 30s and you're working in the Southern District in New York, which, look, you know, pre-Pahara may be have celebrity status. I've represented numerous individuals in front of pre-Pahara's office. And, you know, if you think pre-Pahara was a friend of or an opponent of incarceration, you know, I have several clients that will come on the show and tell you why that wasn't the case. And so does every other lawyer who practices in this town. So it's just a completely upside down narrative that, you know, well, I had this catharsis in my teens, but in my 30s, when I'm building this resume block, because Southern District prosecutor is certainly a resume block, I'm, you know, with enthusiasm seeking mass incarceration. Unfortunately, you know, Lester Holt, when they're strolling down, the boulevard, won't ask him that question because it, you know, upsets the narrative, I suppose.
You know, I just want to, you know, just lately he started up again with the Eric Garner case on Staten Island. Bragg was carrying on about it. I don't know if it's a new lawsuit. It's, you know what, in 6 weeks in New York City politics and everything that goes on, there's just a huge volume of stuff that happens. And then he, after posting, you know, going on about this, oh, I'm going to do this with the Garner family, he goes, but because I'm running for Manhattan DA, I'm not going to comment on it any further. Okay, great. You got all your headlines. You had 40 or 50 people show up.
Why won't he comment? The Manhattan District Attorney.
Well, that was the end of it.
It has nothing to do with a civil suit by the Garner family.
After getting all this huge amount of publicity about this statement, the closer was, but I'm running for Manhattan DA, so I'm not going to comment any further.
Yeah, well, you know, my closer would have been, then why haven't you resigned from the board of directors of the Legal Aid Society then? Because you go to his website, you'll see his name. I starred in the documentary as a prosecutor, the hybrid documentary on the Eric Garner case. I know he saw Garner. And by the way, there's a lot of, from what I understand, there's a lot of tension between Esau, who's Mr. Garner's widow, and the mom, who I think Alvin Bragg represents. But you know, the Garner case was in Staten Island, didn't occur in Manhattan. There's no jurisdiction for the Manhattan District Attorney's office, and that would have long sailed anyway because the case is so dated.
But it goes back to the point where you say people look at him like Lester Holt. They look at this guy like, ooh. You know,
well, because you know, he's their pony. You think Lester Holt, you know, wants to hear what Alvin Bragg has really stood for in his career, or you know, and wants to wrap his arm around a Republican, even one that, by the way, has done a hell of a lot more for the justice.
None of the media people within New York City, I'm talking about street reporters, people that know their business, they won't tackle this guy. They won't. Yeah. They won't even print a negative article about the guy.
I clap at that. You know, I clap at him on Twitter. Look, and people who know me, you know, it's not really my style. I'm not an in-your-face guy. It's very counterintuitive to me. But, you know, I believe in what I'm doing. And, you know, if I'm not using these sort of aggressive tactics, I'm just going to wilt over here like a potted plant, like we talked about earlier. You know, and sometimes they'll, you know, I did a PIX and I said, hey, how about equal time here? And look, in fairness to the report, I think Frank Manorino, I'm probably saying his last name wrong in PIX, they had me on like this over a computer. Then the next week I see, you know, they got Alvin Bragg on and it's another stroll in the neighborhood, you know, in person, in a team, he's got hair, he's got makeup, you know, and it's literally a walk in the park, you know, and I'm here, you know, on a laptop, you know, with a, you know, to speak in.
Yeah. It's just that when you start looking at this guy's history and you look at some of the material that when you search this guy carrying on, I got into it last night with a person who's a director of policy. And a few other people, and with a certain community, a guy in the city council, Keith Powers, you know, these people are all pushing the end of locking these kids up when they're in Rikers Island, when they have to put them in the, I don't have enough coffee in me.
Solitary confinement.
Solitary confinement. The only way to keep control of some of the prisoners on Rikers Island is solitary confinement. Bragg is carrying about it. Keith Powers, these people from up at John Jay, you know, people that never walk the halls of Rikers Island.
I've been to Rikers Island, you know, I don't know if Alvin Bragg's ever been there, but I can tell you that I've been there more in a month than he's probably
Hall
been
is quite a distance from Rikers Island.
But my point being is that the assaults on the corrections officers are skyrocketing.
It's on other inmates too, though, Pete. You know,
without a doubt.
And I know a lot of correction officers. I talk to them. I'm the only attorney that plays on the court officers' hockey team, ice hockey team, and the correction officers are one of our big rivals. You know, you talk to these guys, and you know, it's actually putting inmates at risk. I represented. I won't give details, but a client that you otherwise might not suspect. You know, otherwise. Wouldn't expect to be in Rikers Island, and you know he probably shouldn't have been there, but he wound up there. He rubbed the wrong judge the wrong way. He wound up there for a short period of time. He was well in his 60s, and you know, I was talking to the court. I said, "Look, you know, can you just make sure this, you know, guy is looked after a bit? You know, he's not going to do well in a." And you know, the officer said, "Look, he's like back in the day. You know, we had that. We were able to get that sort of respect from inmates, and." You know, now we can't even do that. We can't even look after the vulnerable because we're under so much scrutiny. The inmates don't respect us, and then we're given favoritism. And it's actually, in addition to obviously putting correction officers at list, it's putting inmates that, you know, aren't the you know, the toughest and the strongest and the most fit at risk. It's awful. And that goes back to the people being terrorized are the same people the progressives say they champion.
But you see this certain, you know, where they just, oh, that's so wonderful. You know, but you know what? Most of the 99% of the people that we would deal with in here in New York County, all right, have never been incarcerated on Rikers Island. They've never, you know.
Well, you know.
Well, my point being is that, you like you said, you go back to the doe-eyed look. Oh, that's so wonderful. That's just the fact. You've never dealt with people in the criminal justice system.
Well, so much of the progressive ideology and the reason why it gets to first base, even though typically you look at this and it's insane, is so much of it is built on myth. The biggest myth is, you know, look, Rikers Island is not now, nor was it ever, populated by nonviolent, low-level offenders who simply couldn't pay their $250 bail.
But that's a great story, though. They love that.
Oh, the story is great, and you know what? I mean, what, you know? Look, Netflix documentaries. I think, you know, with a close second to social media, you know, unfortunately, as entertaining as they may be, have been the ruin of Western civilization because, you know, anybody could put an opinion piece up there and label it a documentary. I mean, look, there's a documentary on Tom Kinnick's race for district attorney, right? It's like a document. It's not objective. I'm telling you why I'd be a great district attorney. I'm not going to deny that. You know, and it just bends the narrative because look, unless I know the criminal justice system, we work in it. I don't know anything about what goes on in a hospital emergency room. So if you show me a documentary based on a hospital emergency room, I'm going to just absorb it all like a sponge and take it as gospel truth. Because what the hell do I know? And that's what goes on. You know, the progressive myth, again, of the low-level offender who just couldn't pay the – too poor to pay the bail is just that a myth. People, I was on with Alvin Bragg. We the one time where I actually got live with him was before the primary with a youth nonprofit youth forum. The same forum, by the way, now invited us on to debate together. He wouldn't do it. He says he's not doing any public debates. And, you know, I told him, I said, look, it's great that you guys are doing this. But one of the participants said, well, you know, I committed theft because I was poor. And I said, well, look, you know, there's always a choice. Poor people don't have to commit crime. That's insulting to socioeconomically disadvantaged people. And secondly, you know, people never went to jail for stealing from a grocery store in New York City. And Albert said, well, that's not true. I knew people. No, you didn't. Okay. Because I've been practicing for 20 years here. I've represented as a prosecutor and defense attorney, I've represented handled more petty larcenies than I could possibly count. I have never had a client, not only have I never had a client go to jail for a first-time petty larceny or even a second time, I'm talking your shoplifting case or what have you, I've never had one convicted of the crime. The standard offer on a petty larceny is an ACD with a couple of days community service. And if it's a big petty larceny, you know, if you go to Bergdorf's and you take a $900 code, all right, you know, maybe they want 5 days community service. You know, if it's your second rodeo, maybe a disorderly conduct, which is a violation, not a criminal offense, as we know. You know, it never happened. People, you know, yeah, people got arrested for marijuana. There may have been racial disparities in that. That's a wrong you want to try and right. They didn't go to Rikers Island for personal possession marijuana cases. Not even close. Not the first time, not the second time, not the third time.
Rikers Island, the whole issue of Rikers Island comes down to a land grab. It's all about getting the land back to redevelop and make a whole new city and create billions of dollars. And we're hiding behind the fact that that's what it is. And we're talking about incarceration as an excuse. And eventually the truth is going to come out. I know that there are documents out there. There's architectural plans out there. And no one wants to talk about it. But that's what Rikers Island is really about. Everything you've said, I've been in the street a long time. Pete's been in the street a long time. 100% correct. Petty larcenies. People are not going to Rikers Island for petty larcenies. I totally agree.
They're going to reduce the population. 300 from over 10,000 that it was only a few years ago. And they're well on the way. I think they're in the fours now. You know, those are not petty larcenists. Those are not marijuana possessors. They're, by and large, people with long criminal histories or violent criminal histories or both. And now 6,000 or 7,000 of those people that otherwise would be off the streets are walking the streets. And then we're going to, you know, try to commission studies as to why violent crime is up in the city.
Well, listen, it came out yesterday. Jumaane Williams has got a great new plan that he's going to push. And I'm like, is this guy delusional? He wants to give at-risk people $1,000 a month. And I'm like, these guys are gangbangers already. You really think they're going to take that $1,000 a month? They're just going to buy better guns, party. And he's putting this out there, and people are like, oh, wow, you know, we have diversion programs.
You can't even take some of the stuff seriously.
Unfortunately, people do.
And they do. I mean, but it, you know, how this isn't a punchline, I don't know.
I can't believe it. I mean, how do you look at this? Like, maybe people would say I'm not really that rational. I might not be. I don't know. But you know what?
You're definitely rational, Pete. I would know you want
to. Yeah, look,
when you look at these things and you just sit back and you're like,
it takes us full circle. Look, that is why this is a winnable race. Look, I'm running on the Republican ticket. I make no apologies for it. There's plenty of moderate Republicans out there, just like, and I would submit it's the majority. Most people gravitate towards the middle. I don't care whether you have a donkey or an elephant. You know.
I think public safety, Tom,
are no exception. You know, I know Manhattan voters well because I know Manhattan juries well. Manhattan's always been my favorite place to try a case because I always say, look, you have intelligent jurors. By and large, it's a very educated population here. And you're not, if you can reach educated people and give them the only rational common sense alternative in a local race where party affiliation really shouldn't mean anything. I tell people, look, I have no opinion on abortion, taxes, immigration. It's outside my wheelhouse. They will vote for them. They're really voting for themselves and their city and humanity. They will do it. I got to get to them.
Yeah, well, you see, public safety, and I've brought this up a lot lately, just with people, especially younger people. I says, in the 1990s, there was a thing called palpable fear. When you walked out on the street, you were worried about getting mugged. You were worried that when you went out to your car, there was no windows left in it. And I said, that was a thing that existed for everybody in New York at that time because it was incredibly unsafe. You know, and these younger people today are like, oh, no, it's safe. No, it's not safe. Public safety is an issue that cuts across all party lines. People want to be safe. Like I said, I'm a lifelong Republican.
Radio signs in every car in the 80s. I was a kid. I remember that.
You know, yeah. I'm a Republican my entire life. But I also get it seems like they have to, well, we can't win. They don't even try anymore. I speak to different people, different groups.
I have no problem with the Manhattan voter. I am fine. You know, 7-1 Republican, Democrat. I'm unfazed. I'd like to take to the woodshed, and I won't name names.
I know.
You know some of them, and you probably can construe who I'm talking about. Really appalling. There's no other way to say it.
Yeah. Well, you know what? When next year, you know, if you're going to sit there with that attitude, then don't throw your hands up and say, oh, well, or then complain about it.
Yeah. You got nothing to say. You know, you want to sit there and say, hey, I'll live like that. Fine. You know, that's your business. I'm not going to, you know, nobody's obligated to support me. Nobody owes me a damn thing.
No, but Tom,
don't go out there and start talking, you know, this and that. And then, you know, when it comes time to, so look, first of all, I'm not a wealthy man. You know, I have criminal defense attorney, I do okay, but I can't self-fund my own campaign. I may not be able to practice law in this city after this election. I'm not fighting a shy campaign. I mean, look, I have every reason to believe ideologically I couldn't differ with Alvin Bragg any more than I do. I have no doubt he's a decent person. You know, his views don't make him a bad human being. And I hope that he, you know, whatever happens in the race, everybody's gracious towards each other, but there's no assurances of that. And all my whole life is based on doing criminal defense work. So I'm throwing it all out there and I'm a nobody, right? I don't have billions. I don't have millions. You know, if you got all those resources and you agree with me again, you don't agree with me. We have no issue. I'm not going to win everyone over, but you agree with this and you see the problem and you're on there ranting about it on media and social media and this and that, and you're not helping. Come on, move on. Get on a plane, move to Florida and.
I'll let you know a little secret. If you don't win this race, you won't be able to practice law in New York anyway.
Well, that's the criminal defense business is drying up.
They won't need attorneys anymore.
I don't think they'll even be locking people up.
I'm
running out of time, but I want to thank you. I would like to bring you back.
I'd love to be back.
We'll bring you back, and you know, good luck on the campaign trails. But I definitely like to talk to you some more.
Yeah, and just one thing, you give me 15 seconds just there. Like, I talk a lot about the big donors helping and so forth. Don't take that as aloofness. I need the help from the people.
Little guys.
If you can give $25, like you have thousands of listeners that probably believe very strongly in this message. You know, if a couple of thousand of them gave $25, you know, I'd have 25, 50 grand. I could buy a lot of media with that right now. You know, we can get commercials, we can get on New York One and so forth. So I encourage everyone. All right. I'm not here talking to billionaires. Do what you, if you believe in me. If you don't believe in me, then obviously you're not going to do anything. But if you believe in the message, please. KENIFF4DA.com. Jump on, make an online donation. I don't care if it's $5, you know, help us out because it doesn't go to me. I'm not going on vacation anywhere or doing anything with it. It's trying to do something for the city and humanity.
It'd be a lot cheaper than moving out of Manhattan too.
Yeah.
Tom, thanks. Pete, thanks. Everyone, thanks for watching To The Point. We'll see you again. We'll have you back, Tom. Thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Good seeing you, Tom.
All right. Take care.